Today on the Potential Psychology Podcast.
One of the things which I get very grumpy about, another controversial point, is STEM. You know, yeah. Oh, we're going to do STEM. Every kid's going to have to learn coding because coding is the future. And quite frankly, it's total and utter bullshit.
Because that's what the robots will do.
Software will write software. And that's already happening. STEAM is probably a better term, which is where you have science, technology, engineering, art, and maths.
Ah, yeah.
Even then, I still think that's a little bit of a furphy. I think we should look at what's called constructivism, which is a way of thinking of constructing knowledge. How do you apply this critical, logical thinking? How do you apply them to building and doing stuff in a consistent manner? All of these are really powerful, real-world things you can do to prepare your kids for being a partner or treating AI as their augmentation.
Welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, psychologist Ellen Jackson, and this is the show in which we explore what it is to be human and how we as humans can fulfill our potential.
Welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. It's great to be back. It's great to be having another conversation with my wonderful co-host, Dr. Joe Sweeney, about the future of work and what we can do to prepare. I think we've come to the conclusion, Joe, that it's not just about preparing kids for the future. It's probably a lot about what we can do to prepare ourselves as part of this as well, isn't it?
I think that was a bit of a light bulb moment. From the last session, which is if you're doing all of these, you know, activities with your kids, you're actually really gearing yourself up well for your own career. So yes, I hadn't expected that. It's always good when you discover something new.
Unintended consequences.
A good conversation, yeah.
Good stuff. So Joe, what is it we're going to be talking about in today's conversation?
We had a question last week from one of our listeners around, you know, what does the future of work actually look like? Really was around job security. And we had quite a few other listeners ask this very similar questions, such as, you know, will my kid actually just be able to get a regular job? How often will they change career? All those sort of questions. Should they learn more, you know, should they go to university and learn more than one discipline so that they could have job flexibility? All those questions were coming up. But we also had some data that would say that a lot of people, more than half of people, I think it was, were concerned about the rise of things such as artificial intelligence and robotics, about just ripping through the job market. Underemployment was another common theme that was cropping up in some of our data. So I thought that we could spend some time really looking at what are the jobs that are going to be, they will remain there. These are the perennials. Now, that said, during this discussion, we'll probably point out that actually internally within those types of careers, there'll be many, many changes going on as well. So I thought we'd just explore, you know, what is going to be stable and then maybe how we can work with our children to prepare them, their interests in those areas, if that's where they lie.
Sounds great. And I think just as you were speaking, one of the things that struck me was this notion of worry. I know we mentioned this in our first conversation that parents, you know, from the data that we've received from both the analysis, but also the kinds of questions that have come through from both listeners and then broader respondents to the survey, is just around this kind of sense of worry that, you know, what will the jobs look like? Will my kid have this? What will my kid need to study in order to maximize their likelihood of career choice? Lots and lots of questions, a lot of uncertainty, yeah. I suppose, which is sort of not surprising from a psychological perspective, because one of the things we've touched on is the fact that, you know, we've had this period of disruption thanks to COVID. And yeah, you know, good and bad.
Good and bad. I'm an optimist.
Yeah.
Take the lessons from it.
Yeah. We've had that.
It was also horrendously tragic for many people I know. So
difficult and stressful. But if we can learn anything from it, we've probably learned a bit about resilience as well. But the disruptions kind of created perhaps some of this worry. I don't know if worry is even the right word. Concern, uncertainty is probably the best word. And for human beings, thinking about the future can be an uncertain prospect, generally speaking. You know, we don't know what it holds. And I think the more we get a sense that it's less predictable than perhaps we thought, whether that's around jobs or careers or around things like global pandemics popping up and just shifting everything for us, or around our own personal circumstances. Uncertainty is uncomfortable. You know, human beings like to feel a sense of certainty. We like to be able to think that we have, it's a bit of a misbelief, but that we have some control over what's going to happen. I think once we get to a certain age, you realize that that control is less and less. But, and that makes sense, therefore, that people would be uncertain around a lot of these elements.
Yeah, look, I think, I guess this episode tries to give, you know, some ideas of where the certainty will lie.
Mm.
I personally react to uncertainty as excitement. I see it as something new is going to come from this.
Mm.
But I'm the sort of personality that loves learning, and I actually love being wrong. I know that's a really weird thing to say. I've had to teach myself it, because whenever somebody says, I don't agree with that, or but the facts don't support that, it gives me a new window for growth. And I was very fortunate. I was raised in a family where at least my mother was very big on that sort of, you know, constantly ask questions, education family. So good stuff there. That's not everybody. And I think that we have to recognize that although we do have a lot more agency than we think we have to shape our children and to, in fact, shape the future of work, mentioned, you know, get active and looking at what the workplace policies are going to be and vote on those things and call your local reps and be involved in that, because that will help. We also have to understand that this is scary. This is scary because it's not just about, ooh, will I have a job? It's really my child is everything to me.
Mm.
And I know very few parents, even in dysfunctional families, if you would want to call them, you know, dysfunctional in quotes, they all actually really care for their kids in whatever way. So yeah, let's accept that this is scary.
Mm.
And then we've got to look at, okay, let's identify those fears and let's skewer the realities of them. And that's where I think we might get a little controversial today. We might get some disagreements.
Okay. Well, let's get stuck into that then. What are the big topics of concern, and what do you reckon things are going to look like?
I want to put the first one out there. We talked about AI a little bit before. You can't pick up a magazine, a tech magazine or a business magazine, without reading something around AI is changing the workplace and we're going to get, you know, total change of workforce and all this
robots
stuff
are taking
going
over.
On. Robots are taking over. And what people actually, when they think about robots, and this is the first bit of controversy, when most people think about robots, they think about those big things that build cars. Mm. And they think about the automated printers that build houses.
I think about my vacuum cleaner. I've got
and your vacuum cleaner.
I love my robot vacuum cleaner.
That will be the least impactful robot we have. The really impactful robots, the ones that we won't see, will be robots that automate software. So think of it this way. We often talk about the economic impact of the decline, particularly in Australia, of the manufacturing sector.
Mm-hmm.
Same in America, all over the world. And a lot of people say, oh, it's because it outsourced to China or wherever. No, it outsourced to robots. If you actually take a close look at what's happening in China now, is they are heavily invested in robotic factories. And those robots are getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. We're getting to a stage now. In Australia, there's actually a little company that started up that will do their entire manufacturing with robots in a small, basically something that looks like a very small office space. And they can produce a lot of very different things with this micro manufacturing. So that type of robotics hit the manufacturing sector. The real upcoming tidal wave of robotics will be in the service sector. So accounting, they're already been hit by this.
Mm.
You can now do most of your bookkeeping by pointing a software package at your bank account and your credit cards. It will take that information, scan them using, I've just got a little phone scanner, and you know, totally reduces the cost. Automated invoicing is a big thing. In fact, I did a study on national productivity through the use of cloud technology. One of the biggest productivity boons in that space is automated billing and invoicing for public services. So we're going to see a lot more software behind the scenes. Now, the interesting thing with this is, and this is where some of the controversy comes. First of all, software automation will outweigh hardware automation by multiple factors. That will have the biggest impact because Australia is primarily a service economy that supports you know, some mining and some manufacturing, but it's a big chunk of that economy of service. So a lot of our service jobs that we currently think are safe are not. Here's the really controversial part. I think that's a good thing. And the reason for that is in most of the areas where I see the greatest and the fastest impact of these sort of software intelligence systems, these are the very areas where we're currently finding it really hard to find staff.
Mm.
So will the software robots fill the jobs that we can't fill? And the obvious answer to that, when you think about it, is, well, duh, there's an economic imperative to solve that problem beyond just the thing of making jobs fast or making tasks faster, better, cheaper, or whatever you want to say. So yeah, there is going to be big disruption in that space. And that's not a bad thing. The other areas, I think, where we need to take a look at AI is that most people don't understand actually what it is.
Mm, well, I was going to ask, what is that? I mean, even the fact that we talk about AI. So artificial intelligence is where the acronym comes from, isn't it?
Yep.
I've only ever had very peripheral conversations about this. And to be fair, whilst I do a lot of nerdy reading, it's not usually in this space. So tell us a bit about, you know, what does it mean?
So artificial intelligence, in the broadest definition, it's a computer algorithm, a piece of software or software robotics that emulates a cognitive activity. So it emulates some sort of a repeatable constant problem decision. Now, you heard me sort of stop when I was saying problem because it's not what we've been talking about earlier, which is problem solving, creating new problems. No, it's a very carefully defined, very narrowly defined decision that needs to happen, and it happens time and time and time and time and time and time again. That's where most AI on the software side is applied now. It can also be used to find out things that we don't know in very large data sets. I'll give you a real example I worked on, and this is going back almost 30 years ago, so this is not new. It was a large horse racing organization, shall remain nameless, and they wanted to know what affected the amount of money people would bet as a whole. What were the variables? And they had massive amounts of racing data, but they couldn't pull, it was too complex to understand what was changing that. So what was fed into that AI was, it's called a pattern matching system. They fed in stock market data. They fed in weather data. They fed in, obviously, all the horse racing data. They fed in a whole bunch of other data to do with shopping habits and a whole range of other things. And what they discovered is the response from the system was, the thing that makes the biggest difference in how much money is bet on a race, is it a Category 1 race or not?
Yeah.
Right. Is it the Melbourne Cup? And they went, yeah, we freaking know that. Next question.
Did all that work and you just told us they already knew?
Yeah. And then the second one was, is it a Category 2 or 3 race? And they go, yeah, we freaking know that. So they got rid of that one. And they said, what's next? And then said, is the spread of odds between this number and this number?
Mm.
In other words, what horses on the spread of odds do we put in? And they went, huh, that's something no one had seen before. And there was a few other little nuances to it. So the weather didn't really matter. It was the spread of the odds.
Mm.
So they started changing the horse racing. And then a couple of years later, they ran the algorithm and said, absolutely, we know that that's working because we could see the numbers come up.
Yeah.
But now the next level is this, and the next level is this. So there was this iteration. So AI can be used to discover things we don't know in very large, complex data sets.
Mm.
So those are two quite different uses of AI. There are other uses of AI that are emerging, such as making robots walk, literally making the hardware robots walk, making your vacuum cleaner know where to vacuum in your house.
I'm sure it's a very, very simple piece of AI, but it's a very, just the fact that I can,
exactly.
I can tell it on my phone screen where I want it to go vacuum and it goes, sure.
That's not AI, that's automation. But anyway,
still clever.
there are definitely some things emerging in that space. Being able to optimize how traffic flows, all of these sort of things are coming up in the AI space. What AI is not is something that's Skynet. Even Alexa and these what we call natural language AIs, they're basically big pattern matching systems. If you want to have some fun, go and argue, start an argument with your Google Assistant. It's speak to it in a broad Australian accent and argue about it. Tell it that it's wrong. And
my husband does this to it all the time.
Yes, it's a great guy. I'm sure it's part of that stress theory. And then you'll see just how limited, you know, that this thing is operating to a set of patterns.
And which is interesting because that's the conversation we often have at home, because he will ask Google to do things or say things to Google. I'm like, it can't do that. You're asking it to do stuff it just can't do.
It gets at all of those hidden frustrations of, you know, poor, angry, sad, fat, bald white men trying to, you know, make themselves justified, feel good about themselves. Well, let's not go into that one. It's a little personal. I can be better than Google. Yes. Getting Google to lie to itself is another great one. But anyway, from that, you can start to see the limitations of what we currently call AI. Now, there is research into artificial consciousness, which is a self-reflective system that does work a little bit more like a human. We are at least another probably 10, 20 years away, but we don't even understand how the brain works. Let's park that one aside.
Yep.
That's what we're talking
about. It'll be a while.
But if you realize that AI is basically big pattern matching systems and based on that, quick decision-making systems, suddenly you see that there's a whole bunch of jobs that are very repetitive, which is why people don't really want to work in them, that can be automated with AI. And those are the jobs that are going to get skewered. You'll still have roles for people in them. They just won't be doing all that grunt work.
And I think, I can even see that just in the context of, you're talking before about invoicing and accounting. You know, when I think about the history of my bookkeeping since I started my business 20 years ago, where you were keeping lots of bits of paper in filing cabinets and having to kind of manually, even if you were using software, it was still very much manual input of data. It was very labor intensive. It was very paper and bits of general chaos intensive, through to using the systems now where, automated bank feeds, the actual intervention by a human being is fairly limited. It's kind of a checking type role.
Exactly.
Rather than a data entry role.
Right. And if you think about, I mean, one of the things that we'll put up a list is there's a way of categorizing types of jobs. It's not a Josephine special. It's just something which is out there, and that's physical and manual work. Basic cognitive, so, you know, simple decisions, yes, no. Higher cognitive, legal work, you know, problem solving. Social and emotional, which would include your career. Counselors, absolutely. Nurses, aged care and so forth. Although aged care also ties into some of these jobs, I think we have to recognize that there's components of both. And then technological, which I would actually argue is almost strictly basic cognitive and higher cognitive. So that's a bit of an argument there from Joe Sweeney. But if we look at this, what we recognize that AI or robotics that we talked about earlier is going to have a fairly significant impact on physical and manual, but not as much as we think it is, because a lot of that change has already happened. It's just that we don't talk about it because we don't see it because it's overseas.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
It is going to come back on shore, by the way. I do think that that's a real option. Then you've got basic cognitive tasks. Bookkeeping and basic tax level tax advice, banking, one, the financial sector, but also basic council services. When are my bins going to get picked up? All that sort of stuff. That is already, certainly with COVID, is rapidly accelerating just being totally automated with these software agents.
Yeah, I suppose even I'm thinking about, and I'm not always a fan of them, but chat functions. You know, from a service point of view, you mentioned customer service, you know, chat functions are sometimes quite useful. Just being able to get at the basic level. As soon as your problem becomes complex, it starts to not work.
And that's why these agents need to be able to get moved from basic cognitive to handing it up to higher cognitive.
Yeah.
And so one of the roles that we are already seeing, and this certainly came through with COVID because so many local councils could not, they saw an increase in demands for services, but at the same time, they couldn't get people to actually, you know, into the office to do the jobs.
Yeah.
So a lot of bots got put in there. So you'll actually have this role where you'll have what we're increasingly calling desktop robots or personal robot assistants. So the people who would be answering the call center and solving these problems on behalf of the citizenry will have access to not only, you know, a chatbot, but access to being able to change that chatbot to more accurately solve their common questions that they don't need to answer.
So it becomes a kind of a learning thing.
It becomes a self-learning cycle. And another area where I've seen this is in machine translation. In other words, computers that can translate. Now, I'm not talking Google Translate. We're talking human level translation, you know, meeting minutes, patents and so forth. We are actually at the stage now and have been for a number of years where the machines have been iteratively learning from the translator. So the translator, he's got this pattern that they have to translate. Like, this is a well-paid job, by the way. They use the artificial intelligence to translate it. They correct that translation. And the next time that artificial intelligence does it better. Mm. Then now these translators are now at a superior to the majority of human translators on niche areas. So medical documentation, there's a whole range of areas for that. And again, the higher level cognitive function, which is checking the machine and helping the machine to be smarter.
So it's almost that, it's that editing piece, isn't it?
Exactly. And there's two types of editing. There's the basic editing of, you know, take a look at Grammarly and other tools such as that. They do a pretty good job of being an editor.
Yep.
Pretty good. Not perfect. But they're getting better and better and better. I've recently been using a piece of software, and I'll send you three images, by the way, to show you how fast these AIs are learning. It's called Midjourney. It makes artwork. So you type in a prompt, you type in something, and the software, this AI, scans across the internet, it uses all sorts of algorithms, and it creates an image based on what you've asked. Version one of this was only about 3 months old, and I'll send you the photo, and it's of an Amazonian warrior, you know, because fantasy geek.
Yep.
And the thing looks, yeah, okay, a bit mutant. Version two of the software, which was just last month, much, much clearer. Version three, it looks like a Hollywood photo.
Yeah.
A hand is still a bit weird. And it's progressing that quickly because of the feedback machine gets from real artists and real people. So, yeah.
That's so interesting, isn't it? Because in all of that you've just spoken about, it's the role of people. So, you know, because quite often we think about, and certainly the everyday conversation, you know, how robots will replace people, how robots will replace people's jobs. But what we're saying is that this is almost a hand-in-hand scenario, that as this technology is evolving, it's the people who are guiding that evolution. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And from a pure technical AI sort of perspective, that's exactly how these machines will learn. So I think of it like this way. It's either William Gibson-esque sort of future where the machines have replaced the people and we've all gone into poverty and, you know, big corporations are all with their big AIs.
Every dystopian novel ever.
Yeah, or it's more like Star Trek where the crew go, oh, computer, tell us this. And the computer says, here's what I know. And the people go, well, then we'll have to bounce a photon beam off the particle field or whatever it is. Computer, go and do that for me. And so it's augmented intelligence.
It's a tool.
It's a tool. All technology is ultimately a tool. And I think that there'll be a segment, a very big segment of workers who would traditionally be employed in this basic cognitive or even some of the higher cognitive jobs. The ones of those that have the most success will be those who can look at these technologies and utilize them and work with them, use them to augment. So we'll all be cyborgs. That just reminds me, there's a company called UiPath. This is not a plug for them, by the way. They make what's called robotic process automation software, RPA, or basically software robots that you can code to do what you want. They have a program where they've got classes running inside business faculties of universities, not tech, to teach all of these business people how to create their own software robots on their own desktops. And then they give them the software for free. Now, obviously, they're seeding the market for the future, but they're literally saying, these software robots that you use to make your job easier, to get rid of all the stuff, this will be as common as a spreadsheet is today.
And yes, so
and I agree with them.
That's that other element of this human side is that we can't just, you know, you think about technology, technical people, IT gurus as being this kind of separate, you know, this skills-based piece that sits to one side, and then the rest of us are kind of overdoing the people things or the business things. Or, and I mean, I think we've probably all come to appreciate, whether we've thought it through or not, and I'm perhaps only thinking this through now as I'm saying it, is that how much we already use a lot of technology just to make our day-to-day jobs easier, whether it is, you know, we have the shopping list at home and we've just trained Google to listen to all of each of our voices. And so as soon as something runs out in the kitchen, it's like Google, please put milk on the shopping list, or please put eggs, or, you know, some of the other things that the children like to put on the shopping list in the off chance that mum might actually buy it when she goes to the shop.
I saw a video of a parrot putting things on the shopping list as well.
Yeah. Goodness me. I just get the dog. The dog's got to update. But so we're already using a lot of these tools, but increasingly it will be important for us not just to understand how to use the tools, but to understand the role that these technologies will play in what we are able to do in terms of not just doing our day-to-day jobs better, but running our organisations better, or our workplace better, or our governments better, or our societies, our lives. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are dangers in this, of course, as well. One of the things I'm very active about talking about is the danger of bias in AI. So going back to, for example, AI isn't biased. AI amplifies the bias that already exists because it's a pattern matching system. I got into a very heated argument recently, which on social media, quietly, where I was pointing out that AI that was doing facial recognition has a very strong bias towards grumpy old white men like me, you know, the white face, and male. And when you ask it to draw images of, say, nurse or teacher or whatever, there's a real prevalence of ethnicity and particularly gender. And I'm saying, if we're serious about creating a more inclusive society, which is a whole other discussion, but if we are serious about this, then we have to make sure that we unbias the information that we're feeding these AIs, because, of course, the AI is getting this information from publicly available media images. And so, of course, it's going to weight them that way.
That's fascinating. So, I actually know we have a local photographer here in Ballarat who has done some significant work on corporate images, and the fact that if you look up any annual report or the website for the corporate images, we have this stock standard way of presenting people. It is not diverse. It is not inclusive. It is not representative. And so, this photographer has been working actively in that space to try and at least just open up that conversation. Because as you say, if the input is only of a certain diversity, then the output can only, potentially amplify that in the wrong direction.
It does amplify it. And this has huge implications. For example, in law enforcement, there's been a number of issues in the States where they're using law enforcement AI for predicting reoffense. Well, you can imagine what the, you know, predictors are on that, because it's feeding in highly socially biased information to begin with. There's all sorts of this stuff going on. We're drifting a little bit away from the topic, which is really,
this is what happens when you have an interesting conversation. You wander off.
So, you know, I think actually all of this, what I take from this is there is a real benefit for us to be working with our kids about looking at some of these tools, understanding them yourself. Doesn't mean go up and become an AI expert, but just know, just look around you and recognize that Netflix is doing this stuff. All of the social media is doing this stuff. Understand it. Think about it. Apply that critical thinking. Who's included? Who's not included? How can I use this? Now, one of the things which I get very grumpy about, another controversial point, is STEM. You know, oh, we're going to do STEM. Every kid's going to have to learn coding because coding is the future. And quite frankly, it's total and utter bullshit.
Because what the robots will do.
Software will write software. And that's already happening. I've got multiple great examples of that. And AI is doing a really good job, a better job than humans, of writing new AI algorithms, or at least being assisted in that. So STEAM is probably a better term, which is where you have science, technology, engineering, art, and maths. Include the arts in there. Even then, I still think that's a little bit of a furphy. I think we should look at what's called constructivism, which is a way of thinking of constructing knowledge. It was pioneered by Seymour Papert. This is going all the way back to the 70s. And when you look at that, it's how do you apply this critical, logical thinking, all the stuff that we talked about, all those lessons, all those skills we talked about, how do you apply them to building and doing stuff in a consistent manner? Now, that might be computer coding, but it could also be Lego. We talked about Lego earlier, I know, offline.
Yes.
Lego is a fantastic, fantastic tool. And Lego robotics for older children, incredibly powerful because it's imaginative, it's all of these things. And it won't be long before there's some sort of an AI patch. I'm sure there probably is one, AI patch for your little Lego robots that you're building. All of these are really powerful, real-world things you can do to prepare your kids for being a partner or treating AI as their augmentation, helping your kids become these cyborgs we're talking about.
Yeah, and coming back to that fear point just on that, I think part of this education, and I use that in a really broad sense, you know, just for all of us, just the learning and understanding around this concept, these ideas that have probably been reported in a way that makes them sound a little scarier than they ought to be. So just being aware of what they are, how they're used, how it works, all the things that we've spoken about today, and then engaging kids in conversation about it in a hopeful way, you know, in that kind of,
yes, you know, yes, this, that's a good point.
This is something that does exist, will exist. It exists because, I mean, we invented it. It wasn't a robot that invented this stuff in the first place. We invented it to make our lives easier in so many ways. So if we kind of accept it from that premise and say, well, this is our invention, we created it as a tool to help us, then how can we continue to do that? Would that be fair?
Yeah, I'm interested in this word hope that you've used there.
Mm.
And I have the sort of brain that just naturally, I'm lazy, so I naturally grab onto anything that's going to make my life a little bit, you know, more layabout. Gives me more time to think. Think and learn and read and do music and all the good stuff which I love to do as a human. But I think that hope is really an interesting element to this because I hadn't really thought of that. I've recognized from that word that I'm actually quite hopeful about the future.
Mm.
Part of that's because I'm an optimist and I can't afford not to be. But what does that look like? Now, unpack that concept.
In the context of?
Of hope.
Of hope. So this notion that we have an element of control, I suppose. We can create our own hope. You know, this is what we know helps human beings in terms of their well-being and their mental health. So if you're worried about a concept like AI or the robots taking over or whatever it might be, then using that element of, okay, my starting point should be I've got to understand a bit more about this, because as soon as I start to understand a little more about it, I feel like I have a little more control over it. I can question it. I can start to factor in and that creates that agency. So we talked about this will and the way, the pathways and the agency that creates that bit of agency that we have because I now understand it a little bit more and I can start to become a participant in it.
Right. So we're sort of talking about the parents there, but how would you then instill that into your children? Because this is not something that education does.
No, I think
at least it doesn't do it explicitly.
It's the doing of it and the conversations around it. You know, it's the role modeling of it for kids to be able to say, and the honesty in, I don't know anything about this. This is kind of scary for me too. Why don't we learn something about it? Let's Google why Google does what it does. You know, that curiosity and the exploration that helps you both to get a better sense of it and then construct your own knowledge and awareness of it that then can build into that hope, you know, because I know a bit more about it. I'm less hands-off. I'm less kind of, oh, that's something that I don't have any control over. So if you think about this hope as being, you know, something you can do and believe you can do, and it creates that sense of agency and control. If the fear is all about a lack of control, it's a pathway to creating the control, I guess.
Okay. So maybe in the next session we can discuss this idea of what are the activities, I'd be really interested in hearing from you, what are the discrete activities that we as parents can do to help our children develop that framework for hope or, you know, the other skills that they might need? I think that would be really, really useful insights. I know it's not something that we've quite planned, but I think at the heart of it, it's one of the most important things in this. How do you maintain explicitly develop that, not just as a, we know we need to do this, we know we need to ask questions, but how do we put in place a program of activity that embeds this in our children and hopefully us too?
I will refer all our listeners back to, again, another very early episode of the Potential Psychology podcast. I spoke to Rachel Collar, who works at the University of Melbourne's, I believe she's still there, the Centre for Wellbeing Science. So she has a lot of knowledge in this area, particularly around kids and how to instill hope in kids and what that means. So she talks about, and I don't know if that I'm going to get it right, maybe I better save it for the next episode, it's the will, the way, and there's another W in there. So you stay tuned to
the why.
The why or that. I'll have to go back to it. I'll have to go back to it. So, but fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. I think we can interrogate that a little bit further as we get into the next conversation.
Excellent.
Yeah. I think we're probably done with this one today, Joe.
I think we are. Let's dive into the next one later.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening in. It seems the robots won't be taking over anytime soon, but there are certainly some ways in which we can help ourselves and our kids to stay adaptable and agile in a world of work that is just going to keep changing and changing rapidly. So, if you haven't seen them already, we have put together some summary one pages for each episode of this series of the podcast, keeping you abreast of everything and perhaps a little more that Joe and I talk about. And they come complete with some fab graphics, thanks to our team member, Jay. And these infographics include some additional tips on helping your kids to thrive now and into the future. And we say kids, but as I've mentioned a few times so far in this series, there's absolutely nothing that we recommend for kids that isn't equally, if not more important for us as adults. As you've no doubt gathered from Joe and my conversation so far, we're big believers in implementing everything that we discuss in our own lives. So please take a look at these great additional resources. You will find them on the Potential Psychology website with a link in the show notes and see how much applies to you. And if you'd like to know more about my co-host, Joe, we have a link to a fun Q&A in the show notes, and we have our interactive show features if you're listening on Spotify or Anchor, including our Q&A. And you can send me a voice message on Anchor, which is pretty cool. Maybe you have a question for me or for Joe. Maybe you have a great suggestion for a topic you'd like to see us cover on the show. Let me know. That's at anchor.fm/potential psychology. And we'd also love it if you could rate and review the Potential Psychology podcast on whichever platform you're listening on. It is amazingly helpful feedback for us, and it does ensure that the word gets out about our show and the great guests who share their wisdom with us. And finally, don't forget that you can now become a special VIP member of the Potential Psychology podcast community with access to our bonus episodes. To find out more, head to our website, potential.com.au, or to anchor.fm/potential psychology/subscribe. And in our next conversation, Joe and I will be discussing something that is not at all technological, but it is vital to a thriving future, and that is hope. So hope is so much more than crossing our fingers and wishing for the best. It's actually a motivational process that we can learn, and we can help our kids learn to put them in the driver's seat for their future. It is a great tool for dealing with life's challenges also. That's in our next episode of the Potential Psychology podcast in your ears very soon. And while you're waiting for that, stay well, stay safe, and take small steps to fulfill your potential.